I would interview people who I wanted to do business with. So that was one. The second was, I will interview someone else adjacent that has that information that would convince you to talk to me. And then the third was just interviewing really interesting people with the kinds of questions that would give someone the perspective that I'm probably someone they want to work with. And that alone brought in probably 50% of my business when I used to get maybe 20 or 30% besides the actual referrals.
Welcome to the More Clients, Less Effort podcast, where we provide expert insights and strategies to turbocharge your business growth. I'm your host, Tim Hyde. And in this series, we'll unpack the secrets, proven systems, and the sales and marketing strategies used by successful business owners to attract, convert, and keep A-class clients on autopilot. Whether you're a seasoned entrepreneur looking to scale your customer acquisition or a budding startup owner looking to crack the code on attracting the right clients, you've come to the right place. Join us on this journey to building a thriving business that leaves a lasting impact. Now let's get started. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of More Clients, Less Effort. And I'm joined today by my friend, Andrew Deutsch. Andrew's a multilingual global strategy, marketing and sales consultant who has successfully driven business growth in more than 100 countries. His extensive global travel experience, creatively melding practical strategic business concepts with solid psychology theory, is behind his bold and innovative methods. Andrew's superpower is the ability to see opportunities where others do not. His company, Fangle Group, is a strategic growth consultancy helping clients convert every touch into voracious appetites for their brand. Services include fractional leadership, in-depth research beyond financials for mergers and acquisitions, in addition to total branding and go-to-market strategy creation. You can check out Andrew at fangledtech.com or his podcast on the Fangled Cast, which I've listened to. It's a great, great show. Andrew, welcome.
Thank you.
To More Clients Left Out.
Yeah. Now that we went through all that, we're out of time.
That's it. Thanks very much for joining us, though, guys.
By the way, it's voracious advocates for your brand.
There we go. I should probably clean my glasses first thing in the morning. Voracious. Well, advocates. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the thing, right? You know, when we look at marketing is not just the ability to attract attention into your world, is it? Marketing is really this whole customer journey that also talks about how do you turn people who otherwise don't know who you are into advocates and promoters of you?
Yeah, I ask the question all the time, what would happen if everybody you met, not just people who bought something from you, was out there telling the world how great you were? That's really what it's about.
Yeah, and how would you do that?
Best example are luxury brands. How many people who just absolutely love that Porsche or the Ferrari or whatever that crazy brand is and talks about the greatest car in the world, never going to own one in their life?
Yeah.
They're huge advocates for those brands, and they're never, only a tiny, tiny percentage of them are ever going to be able to even sit in one.
I remember as a kid, I used to have a Ferrari Testarossa poster on my wall.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to tell the same joke. Yeah. I got a Ferrari at home. It's a Hot Wheel. But
the tiny little
since I was seven.
The tiny little matchbox car. Absolutely. I know you had a long career in corporate. What was it about, you know, the other side of the coin, the entrepreneurial side of the coin for you that attracted you into business in the first place?
Yeah, well, I had an incredible inspiration. My grandfather was one of the guys that you'd hear during the Depression made a nickel a day sweeping the floor at a printing company and learned everything he could learn. And before long, he had the largest adhesive printing company, printing on adhesive labels in the entire region. At one time, our family made something like 80%. My percentage may not be accurate, so sue me, but I think it was 80% of all carbs made in the United States, the batteries had a label on them. We made those battery labels. So I learned from a guy who was inspired from starvation practically to running this very prosperous business. And even as a kid in school, I always came up with stuff to make money. I sold t-shirts with the rock bands on it that I bought legally through. I found out that after the concert tours were over, the shirts were available for pennies on the dollar, and I would get them and sell them. When I was in college, I somehow managed onto the list of every student on campus's home address and birthday. And we would send letters home to the parents 30 days before their birthday saying, if you send me a check for this, we'll bring your kid a birthday cake. And so we'd buy the cake for $5 and get $20 and paid my way through college with that kind of stuff. So I was always sort of into that. How do you hustle legitimately, ethically, and make money? Pyramids, no MLMs, none of that nonsense. And then I went to school. I wanted to be in global trade. I'd been an exchange student. I lived in Sweden as a kid. And graduated, and there were no jobs. And every MBA I knew was unemployed back in those days. So I went back to school.
That was a telling sort of thing. It's like, why would I want to do an MBA when I can just actually go and make the money?
So I went back. I went to grad school and studied basically what would be clinical psychology with a focus on business to really have a resume that was different. Multicultural marketing and the ability to understand how to convert. You know, you can't just translate a brochure. You have to actually speak in the value proposition of the other country.
Yeah.
So it created this sort of ambiance of here's a guy who's different than everybody else, and projects started to come. So in 1993, if I remember right, I went down to Brazil for a 90-day consulting gig and ended up living there for 10 years and built my business there before I came back to the U.S.
Now, you originally created it as the Deutsch Group after your name.
Yeah.
Lesson learned there. Share that with me.
We were the Deutsch Group. And then I registered in Brazil as a company. We came back to the States and I kept the Brazilian office open and was operating it here in the States. We had bid on a major project that we got for a manufacturing company. And the group that we beat out that thought that it was their customer decided to look into it. I had never registered Deutsch Group in the US. So the next thing I knew, I was being threatened with this massive lawsuit for using my own name. And at that time, this was around 2007, maybe. The economy was falling apart, and one of my biggest clients had just let go their head of international and said, can you please join us and fix our international sales division? Can you come in and restructure it? So rather than continuing with this name I couldn't use and otherwise, I became an actual employee for the first time in many years and got involved in this. It was an end-of-line packaging manufacturing company and just blew the doors off of it. Then I started, I was traveling. I was in 45 countries every year. 300,000 air miles. And we went from, I want to say it was 3.2 million, if I remember right, in 16 countries. When I left that company 5 years later, we were doing, I think it was 11.4 million in sales in 75 countries.
Yeah. And we're talking not really a fancy, exciting product here. We're not talking Ferraris. What we're talking about
is plastic strapping
tape that goes around.
Yeah. You pick up those little handles that come on the newspapers, you know, that aren't really handles, or you pick up a box or hold stuff to a pallet. But in that time, I was also involved because I was overseas. I was involved in and ended up taking on the responsibility for what they call purchase products. So I was then doing total market research to reinvent and retool all of the tools that are used in the industry. We found where the pain points were with the existing tensioning equipment and sealing equipment and stuff like that, and found out what would make them better, and then getting the engineers involved to develop it. And when we hit the market with it, they became the benchmark in the industry. Something as simple as this: if you've seen a person, you know, doing a pallet, you've got this tensioner and you're pulling this lever and it's making the tighter, tighter, tighter. You've got two problems. How many times do you pull that thing to make it go a meter? How much strength will it hold before it slips? Because it's basically just digging into it. Yeah. So we doubled the ability to hold so it wouldn't slip. So I don't know in kilos, but in pounds, the max pull you could get was about 800 pounds. We got it up to 1500 pounds without it slipping. And we changed the gearing in a way that if you pulled the lever six times before, it would move a meter. We got it down to three to move a meter, so it was faster. And we changed the grip so they're more ergonomical. We basically created an entire product development system designed on not what we thought was right, but what the consumer wanted. And so I developed all of that during the time I was there also, which was really exciting.
It's interesting how, you know, when we look at, I guess, you know, our marketing strategy, sometimes our marketing strategy is just actually having a better product than a competitor.
It is. Well, there's three kinds of products that come to market. I see a real problem, a real pain. I have a solution. And when I show you the solution, you're going to go, oh my God, thank you. Where have you been all my life? That's one. Yeah. Two is I recognize a pain the consumer may not, but when they see my solution, they'll feel their pain. That's like an iPhone. Who knew you needed all that on a phone? But when all of a sudden you say, oh my God, I could do my account, I could do all of that, I didn't realize I had the problem. Then the third is I'm solving a problem nobody ever had, nobody ever will have. And if I'm not clever enough, nobody's ever going to buy it. And that's usually, I don't know in Australia, but here at 3 o'clock in the morning and the commercials, it's like, you didn't know you were having trouble putting your shoes on. We've solved it. Yeah. Finally, a safe way to open a can. Like we have hospitals filled with people who've unfortunately dealt with the fickle fate of the can. Those products I don't deal
with. Those can openers. Actually, I do recall, I'm a big fan of things like Shark Tank and Dragon's Den.
Right? Yeah.
And I remember an episode of Dragon's Den, which is the BBC version, right? Been around for 20, 30 years already. And one of the pitches I saw was a young inventor who came in and was pitching an attachment to toothpaste tubes.
Yeah.
right? And it was going to go on all of these tubes, these, you know, these makeup tubes, toothpaste tubes, et cetera, right? Anything that had product in it to get the last little bit of product out of the tube, right? Mm-hmm. And they've gone, and one of the dragons has said, well, what does this, you know, this is one of these inventions, I guess, that you didn't know you needed. Yeah. But here it's going to say, change your life. What does it solve? And he says, oh, you know, what does this product cost? And he's gone, it's about 8 pence, right? So I don't know what that is in cents, maybe 15 cents, I guess. And he says, okay, well, okay, how much product is left in the tube? Is this thing saving? So they've gone, oh, about 2 or 3 pence worth of product.
Yeah.
I'm going, are really people really going to buy this thing that costs them 15 cents to save 3 pence worth of product?
I've got an identical story you're going to love. So guy comes to me with this. He wants to go to market. It's a system where you put all the left, you know, when you use soap, eventually there's a piece of soap that's too small.
Yes.
So you put it in there. And eventually when it gets to a certain level, you turn the thing on and it melts it into a new bar of soap. And then you reuse it. Of course, you know, how much is a bar of soap? Even the fancy stuff isn't that expensive. But I said, I want to show you the solution that you solved. And I put my hand out. I said, here's the old bar of soap. Here's the new one. Done. You just stick the old soap to the new soap and get in the shower. And there's absolutely no need. And he said, well, I thought this was going to be a great product because I failed with my last one. What was your last product? It was some sort of a heating pad for the kitchen sponge so that it would sterilize it so that you could use the sponge for longer. And that thing was going to retail for $30. And it's, you don't want to be condescending. You don't want to be one of those guys, but those two, it was really difficult to not just go stick to your day job because they were both ideas that, you know, had nowhere to go. And I understand later on, he tried to come out with something else that was even crazier, but I don't remember what it was. At the end of the day, if you're not solving a pain, a problem that either people recognize or will recognize as soon as they see your product, you're really not going far.
I think that's a good rule in general for product development, isn't it? We're talking services here as well. It's not just physical products like a glass or a strapping tape or,
To finish the story. So I left there and went to work for a Fortune 100 company that was specialty in adhesives in their tapes division. Mm. And the idea there was they had all of these incredible technologies of adhesive that most people wouldn't recognize. But imagine an adhesive that's so well made that you could put it on the landing gear of a plane sitting in the desert at 125 degrees, 180 degrees. And within a minute, the plane is at, you know, 30,000 feet at 40 below. And that adhesive would hold, or an adhesive that had special properties of, you know, you could put something to it and it wouldn't stick, but the slightest pressure, it can't be moved. So at real high shear, as they would call it. So these, what else can we do with these products? So really, it was like a kid in a candy store. This thing is made for the microchip industry. What else can we use that for? And doing the research, finding the market, scaling it. And I really enjoyed doing that because it was like being Mr. Inventor without having to invent. It was, how do we use your invention? And then after that, I got back into sort of the consulting space. So private equity groups would bring me in when they would buy a company and it would get stuck. And the typical mindset in PE is it's all about the money. If the business is failing, maybe we need to cut costs and do this kind of stuff. I would come in and look at it from a growth perspective of where are you missing your target from a marketing, from an operational perspective, and really got into that deep research into what does the consumer of that product in the industrial space or consumer space really value, and how can you differentiate in a way to serve that market unlike anyone else? So
companies don't do that research?
A lot of times they jump the gun. And we also do, which is not on my website, but we promote it quite prominently to private equity, is what we call PE forensics. So private equity is looking at a company and they can read the bottom, the balance sheet, and do all the research they want. We have the ability with the way we do research to get into the market and find out where they really are.
Yeah.
So like one year there was a private equity group we talked to that was about to buy a company that, I don't want to get into specifics, but they had a product, 80% of their business was with three different companies. And in our research, we reached out to those companies, not on behalf of them, but on behalf of research that we were doing as Fangl Group, to discover that there was an alternative product that was being tested that outperformed them and was cheaper. So literally gave them the warning, do not buy that company because you're going to lose all the business within the first 6 months. They backed out of the deal. The other company bought it, and we were wrong. It was 3 months. They went from a $14 million company to a $6 million company in less than 3 months because the alternative version of this product that they didn't have the patents on took over the market. So
I think that's the thing about marketing. We're talking, you know, really at a deep strategic layer here, aren't we? Not necessarily the tactic of what Google Ads will run or should have on TikTok or not. We're talking about how does your company is actually going to perform, and do you have a product that has longevity or a service that has longevity in the market? Right? Because it's constantly changing. Everyone's kind of jockeying for position to try and do something ahead of someone else. And if you're not kind of working on it constantly, you've got to be left behind. I think the AI conversation is obviously a really big one at the moment. You know, you might not be adopting AI, but your competitors certainly are.
Yeah. And really, it's about when you're stuck in, I hate the word because commodity can mean different things to different people. But if you're in a commoditized market where you say, I do this for a living, and everybody goes, oh, everybody does that. How do you deliver it? How do you go through what you're doing in a way that makes you stand out? So for example, I did work last year with a company that does home power washing. Well, at the end of the day, everybody in that business has got high testosterone marketing and they're tough guys and they're out doing the hard work and all of that. And when we did some research, we recognized homeowners are scared of them. I don't want that guy in my yard. Well, what would happen if you took the testosterone down and instead created a business that whoever's home with the kids will be happy that you're in the yard, and build marketing materials and run your tactics based on premium work from people you trust and you would welcome in your yard. And all of a sudden, they were getting the higher ticket and not chasing the cheap, you know, low dollar jobs that, if they say in the industry here, they call it chucking a truck or Dan in a van. You know, that guy whose hygiene is questionable, who's supposed to be in the cleaning business. Let them have the low dollar tickets and we'll get the higher because we're the trusted ones in the market. We marketed the company based on that. Yeah. And it made a huge difference.
Do you think there is much difference between a product-based business like adhesives or strapping or whatever to a service, whether it's a trade or a professional service? Is there much different in the psychology of marketing?
Absolutely. If I'm a buyer at a corporation who's buying plastic strapping, for example, what I want is to make sure that my decision never shuts down the factory, because if it doesn't arrive on time, it's defective, it doesn't perform well in my equipment, I literally could stop producing everything in the plant because we can't package it. My role there is that first, and then making sure I meet my budget and that the economics are there. And that's typically the beginning of it. And that I'm dealing with a company now that there's all sorts of environmental incentives out there to be able to say that our green scorecard improves because they're using recycled material. All of that stuff is involved in the motivation structure of how you sell it. Years ago, we took over this major industry in Brazil with imported strap from the US. And the entire purchase was not so much price based on the actual cost of the material. The competitor's material had a failure rate in the equipment of something like 4%, and ours was 0.001%. So every time there was an error, there was a 20-minute or 10-minute or 5-minute, whatever it was, depending on the error, recycling of the machine and waste to get it up and running again. We eliminated downtime, and the downtime was the value that it sold. Now, if I'm out selling home services, very few of those factors matter. The home services, are they going to be able to fix it at the right price? It's not going to break down again because, you know, they actually did the right thing. And is the guy coming in my house going to scare the crap out of me or stink up the place or do more damage than good, try to upsell me, try to twist my arm into other things? It was a very different dichotomy. But when you understand what that motive structure is, the value proposition, whatever buzzword you want this week, that's where the magic comes, is really understanding what the consumer wants and knowing what the persona of the consumer you're dealing with is so that you can market to that persona.
Yeah. I think that understanding of who your client is, how they think, why they should give a shit about what it is that you're doing is so critically important.
Yep. When I did a sales training way back in my career for a car dealership, and I was observing in the car dealership, people would come into the dealership, what brought you in today? The crap, looking at cars, what's wrong with you? I changed the dialogue. People would come into the car dealership. They would ask the question, I'm curious, what do you like about the car you're driving now? What do you like about it? Oh, well, it's fast. It looks good. And you can start to get where their emotions were. It drove fast, so I have a feeling. It looks good. I have a visual. The girls seem to like it. Whatever those were. And then you ask, well, what don't you like about it? And in that beginning of probing questions, you're learning more about that customer than you'll ever learn by, hey, how's it going? You know? And then from there, so you've got the order of what was interesting to them. There was a field and there was a vision and then, you know, whatever. Based on what you liked and disliked, let me show you this vehicle over here and repeat back in the same and get that feedback from the person and really understand who they are. And chances are you've now advanced that purchasing process by six steps. Because first of all, you're not pissing the person off by asking a dumb question. Waitress comes by your table at a restaurant. Would you like some food? No, no, I was just here for the ambience. It's really about understanding. It's about asking the right
question. It's a silly question, isn't it? It's like, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, just on your car story there, I remember years ago, I bought a Mazda CX-9 just because it had lots of cup holders.
That's funny.
That was my main buying criteria.
There was a brand years ago that was advertising that had more cup holders than anybody else. I can't remember what it was. I always thought it was kind of funny. You're the first person who's ever said that to me.
I'm not one buyer of that brand in the world.
Yeah. Well, Mazda's an interesting case because years ago, back in the 80s, they shifted their marketing thinking, let's be the only brand that markets to women. And they started to design the car with a female aesthetic and whatever. But that was still before women really became equals in the market. So guys thought that the cars were wimpy because they were girl cars. And if a woman was in a marriage with a dominating husband, even though she desperately wanted the car, oh no, I'm the one who's got to maintain that thing. You can't have it. And that was when they had their market decline. And now that women have really taken their place in the market and have become powerful equals in the consumer space, Mazda's really, really grown again. And the cars are not really feminine now. They're for everybody.
Yeah.
But they have a stronger female brand recognition in the US, at least, than many of the other cars.
It's interesting. I got a mate of mine who's in video production, does a lot of video and animation work with some major brands. We were talking about this the other day because most people will sort of market features and benefits, right? Luxury car brands and luxury brands in general do not at all talk about the features and benefits of their product. They purely market to the emotional state, that how it's going to make you feel, you know, what it's going to do to your ego and your status amongst your peers. Yep. And it reminds me of another guy I know who bought a Ferrari in the US, right? Quite a successful businessman. Yeah. And he bought it and it came with a whole bunch of extra friends, unexpected friends. And then just for shits and giggles, he sold the car to see if the friends would stick around, and they did not.
Yeah, those are what I call real friends. But we've been advocating for years, stop talking about features and benefits. It's benefits and features. That's, flip it, because benefits sell. Features are the delighters. So my favorite example is environmentally friendly products. Or if you lead with the product is environmentally friendly, the typical consumer goes, oh, it doesn't work. It's weak. It's whatever. Now, it isn't necessarily true, because in the chemical space, which we do quite a bit of work, we have products that are pH neutral, safe for direct release into soil and water, that outperform dangerous stuff. But if you go to market with a product that it performs, it cuts your cost, it always arrives on time, we've got great customer service, and by the way, a delighter is it's environmentally friendly, you can use it on your scorecard, then the environmental part of it becomes extremely important until you shift generations. The new, Gen Z now that's coming into the place, the environmentally friendly part means more to them than all the previous, the millennials and Gen X and all of it. But at the end of the day, if you lead with how I solve your problems and make things easier for you, all of that, you have a much better chance of really, you know, engaging with folks and creating those advocates that we were talking about before for your brand. Mm. The delighters are not the values. The lighters are the other part.
Makes me think I missed the mark with my year 11 business assignment, which ironically I failed, but we had to come up with a product and a marketing plan on how to launch it. And I came up with wax covered recycled cardboard produce trays, right? For organic produce, which are everywhere now, right? And it was going to cost, I think, extruded polystyrene at the time, which was very common in the early 90s, was a 0.2 cents, right, per tray. And mine were going to cost 7 cents per tray.
Yeah.
I don't know how I came up with that number as a year 11 student.
Yeah,
I failed that because she thought the product wasn't realistic.
And let's go back to your Shark Tank story before. There was a Shark Tank episode. There was a young woman who invented a folding shipping box. So it would show up on site. It just folded open. You didn't have to tape it or anything. It was ready to use. And then when you were done, you could fold it right back down and stack it. And that Mr. Wonderful, who I have almost no respect for at all as a person or businessman, if you look at his history, his supposed software prowess, he was a junk dealer. But anyhow, he said to the woman, how much does a cardboard box cost? She said, oh, cardboard box is $1. Well, yours is $2 and something. So there's no way you're ever going to sell that thing. And me, as a guy who's been in the end-of-line packaging space, I'm looking at the box going, that thing's genius. Why? Because it costs money to open a box, fold the flaps, put tape on the box.
Yeah, all the hidden costs.
Yeah, there's all of the costs. I used to sell the equipment, the carton erectors and automated systems to put the tape. It's expensive to do that. And it's more than a buck when you start adding up, especially for the small consumer that's using hand tape dispensers. Mm. She really had a valuable product, but because He didn't know that he was comparing apples to mangoes instead of apples to apples. Nobody bought into her business, and it was brilliant. But it's a false comparison if you don't look at the total value.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? But if we've got to look at one of the biggest value propositions, I think, is we've got to talk about how does our product make my customers' life easier?
Yeah.
Right. And that has value, right? Because time is the one thing we can't get back, right? If you can give your customer time back with their family, that's invaluable.
Yeah.
And people will pay for that.
Yeah.
What do you use in your business? How do you attract customers systematically? I know we touched on it briefly earlier. I know you're not necessarily going, you know, you don't necessarily need to throw your money into Google ads. What's the system that you use?
I don't spend a penny for my consulting business. I don't spend a penny with Google to do it.
Yeah.
I attract business through things like this, where people can hear me and decide this is someone that I should consult. I offer on my website, if someone wants to consult with me on a project, I have a free pick my brain session. I do two or three a week. Anyone who's got access to the link, so I don't end up with, you know what, weird stuff, can actually book 30 minutes with me to flesh out an idea. So that's sort of at the core. I've got the referral basis of all the advocates of great companies and people I've worked with over the years. I do significant networking among the market of people who I do business with. My podcast, which I've got on hiatus and I'm just now bringing back, was my biggest lead gen that I had because I did three kinds of interviews. I would interview people who I wanted to do business with that wouldn't give me the time of day. But if you call them up and say, hey, you're in this industry and you're an expert in it, and I'd really like to talk to you about it and explain your path of your career and otherwise, it would open that door. So that was one. The second was, I tried to get to you. I know that I've got a project that can help your business. You won't talk to me. So I will interview someone else adjacent that has that information that would convince you to talk to me and then get someone of influence to get you to watch it. And then the third was just interviewing really interesting people with the kinds of questions that would give someone the perspective that I'm probably someone they want to work with. And that alone brought in probably 50% of my business when I used to get maybe 20 or 30% besides the actual referrals. And then many times, you know, I'll publish and I do a lot of articles. If you follow me on LinkedIn, anybody can. There's lots of information that really digs into the peripheral part of what we do. But really, I mean, I've been at this a long time. So the reputation builds my business. There's very few clients I have that I recommend that path. But with clients, depending on what their industry they're in, I'll give you an example. In the home services business, everyone out there is literally at each other's throats bidding on and raising the cost of the keywords, the pay-per-click ads and everything for home services. So if you're power washing houses, you're going back and forth. Your cost per lead sometimes is more than what you could possibly make on a job. It just is. So Google has within its system, they've got the map where if you do your organic and stuff properly, you can get into the map. And then they have their LSA program, which I don't know if they have in Australia, which is Google investigates your business, basically. And you sign up for their program. And if you've got the proper insurance, the proper history, the right reviews, they then basically bonify you as a business. And you get leads from the LSA, which is the first ad that shows up. And those are less expensive. So that's one part of it. But again, that's going to become a crowded space. So what we did instead of that, we did LSA, we grew that, and then the owner of the business continues that, and it's a great source, is going back to the old school feet on the street. So one of the lead gen campaigns that we did, we would get a lead in a neighborhood where we're going to do someone's home, and then we would advertise to everyone else in that neighborhood. At one point, we were taking photos of every house on the street. So we're doing this house on the front of the card. On the back of the card is the actual consumer's house. And with a quote, but we would charge to do it. And we're going to be in the neighborhood on May 5th. So if you book on May 5th, this is your cost. And what was interesting was it brought in a lot of business. It also created a kind of controversy you want. Because a guy would call you pissed off. Who told you you could put a picture of my house on the card? You say, well, it was public. You know, you're on a public street. And the only person who saw your house was you. We didn't use your house, but it did get you to call us. And we're going to be in the neighborhood. And for every one that was irrevocably upset with us, four or five would sign up to have their house washed.
Yeah. It's funny how that sort of thing, you know, people are going, oh, what if someone doesn't like me? I'm going, well, that doesn't matter, right?
But if you've got good salespeople, they like you.
Yeah.
They're upset for the moment. But if you meet them at their model of the world and understand that they're upset and explain that they shouldn't be, that and why you benefit them, you can get the business. There's an old story about an insurance guy, first day on the job back in the 50s. He calls up a guy and says, yeah, I'm calling from Acme Life Insurance Company. And the guy says, screw you. I don't want any insurance. And the guy says, thank you. I just made $10. You made $10? I told you no. Yeah, they told me I'd close 1 in 10. I get $100 when I make a sale. So you saying no is $10 in my pocket. The next guy will say no. By the time I get to 10, I'll have $100. Thank you. And then they got in a conversation. They made friends and he sold them insurance. But the other one, and again, you know, we're talking cross culture. In the US, 80% of homes being built today are in what's called a homeowners association. Do you have those in Australia also?
Yep.
So they're highly regulated and it's usually the nosy neighbor who's in charge. So all of a sudden, notices go out to 50 houses in a neighborhood of 51 houses. Your house is dirty, and if you don't have it washed by such and such time, you're in violation. You're going to be fined. So one guy would call up and say, hey, I'm in this neighborhood. I need my house washed, and I need it done by next Friday. Can you do it? Absolutely. Our minimum is $300. But if you'll allow me to come out and put a yard sign that says we're washing the house, and I'm going to put door hangers on everybody else's door in the neighborhood, telling them that we're doing your house for $200. If they do it the same day, they get the same discount. Is that okay? And then you send a crew out. The crew goes out and they door hanger every door in the neighborhood on May 7th. It's only $200, regular $399. And then when you go out to do the house wash, you go, well, the house is included, but you know, we can do your driveway when you're here. We can do your sidewalk. We can concrete seal. And all of a sudden, a day that would have been a $300 job becomes $2,000 or $3,000.
Yeah, I had the same with a roofing company. One of my first clients was a roofing mm-hmm. company, and the same thing. And you know, it's like, what can you see from when you're standing on someone's roof fixing it? All the other roofs.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so and you just literally just door knock and say, hey, I noticed I was on your neighbor's yep. roof there, and I noticed you've got yep. some damage that might be yep. causing you insurance issues. You know,
yeah.
While we're here, he wants to get up and take a look before you.
Yeah. And there's another piece to it, too. The neighbors can see you up on the roof. We created what I joked was the sign festival. When the truck arrives, they stick a stake in the ground with a 15-foot teardrop banner that's there. They put a stake in the ground with brochures and yard signs on each end. Anybody driving by is going to get attention and see the guys working and stop and ask the question. Mm-hmm. And then with the roofing business, which is really interesting, was a project that I was involved with, not directly, but adjacent, with what's called geofencing and tying it into the National Weather Service here in the US. So we can set up an automation that the moment hail is hitting a home in a neighborhood based on the weather service, the satellite, the cell phones within that boundary start getting all of the advertising from the roofing companies about insurance repair on damaged roofs and immediately start impacting people and generating leads. And it's incredible how many leads come.
Yeah, one of the key things here, and certainly my big takeaway from our conversation, yeah. Andrew, is it's, you know, marketing is quite a complex beast.
Yes.
Right? You know, and not just the attraction of new mm-hmm. business, which is obviously the sort of the main focus of marketing, but the retention of marketing as well, mm-hmm. as you say, you know, it's how do we take these customers and turn them into advocates of yep. what it is that we do, right? So give someone a discount, they become an advocate, right? They tell their neighbors about yep. it. Is that there's so many different tactical implementations that we can look at outside the I must be on Facebook and put up social yeah. media posts every yeah. day, and you know I must be on Google AdWords because I want to attract intent-based buyers. Those are absolutely legitimate strategies. You know, the deeper layer from that is there are other strategies and tactics out there that, as long as we're monitoring the cost of acquisition, might actually get us customers at a cheaper price, which allows us as a business to be more competitive against yep. complacency and other competitors in the market.
Let me lay one more piece into what you just said that was, I think, is very interesting. And I don't know in Australia if the consumer thinks the same way as here. If somebody tells me they're going to give me a discount, I'll take it because it's a discount. But at the same time, I recognize that the original price wasn't the original price. And I kind of, as a consumer, go, yeah, they could have given me that price in the first place. Instead, if someone comes to me and says, hey, we can do your job for this much, and by the way, when we're there, we're going to do this extra thing for free, that has much more impact. So instead of, hey, we can discount the price, it's while we're there, we can degrease where your trash cans are. We can do, you know, in the house washing model, we're going to come out and we're going to service your furnace, and our normal price is $299. We don't discount it. But if we can book it this week, when we're there, we'll blow out your dryer vent to get the lint out to keep your house from burning down. We'll do an extra thing for you. That's far more powerful because now I'm solving an additional problem for the same money, as opposed to discounting and looking like a cheap brand.
Yeah, not a fan of discounting in general.
Yeah, I mean,
let's start to see the.
Let me take it back. I like it if I'm the one getting the discount, then I'm okay with it.
Please feel free to offer discounts on a regular basis. We're all good with that. What's one initiative on your whiteboard that wasn't there 30 days ago?
In business right now?
Yeah.
I'm working on a product launch for a chemical product that's used in exterior cleaning that's completely biosafe and under regulation can be released into soil and water. In the U.S., it's illegal to use a soap to wash the pier at a dock, and this is something that can do that. It can lift grease and oil and go right down the drain without having to recapture the water because it's safe. And there's also an issue here. If you take a boat out of one body of water and put it in another, it has to be cleaned. And you can't do that at the marina because the soaps that are used can't get into. So I'm working on a business plan based on that. It's really interesting.
Yeah, that looks fascinating.
Yeah, looking for the funding and getting that off the ground.
What's your favorite way to shorten the time that teams takes to turn prospects into customers?
Showing up. Being there.
So easy, right?
Yeah, it's the best. The most important part of sales is actually, asking for the money. At the same time, it's also, being there.
Yeah.
No, don't waste time.
What would your grandfather, who's clearly a big inspiration for you, think of what you're doing now? What would he say about it?
Oh, he'd be proud. Yeah, I know it.
Yeah. All right. What do you think of marketers?
I think most marketers don't recognize the difference between being a tactician and a strategist. And it's so often, I wrote a thing just recently about the difference between a CMO, a chief marketing officer, a chief growth officer, and all that. And it drives me crazy when someone thinks that they're a executive level marketing person. And when you ask them, well, what do you do? Well, I do Google Ads and organic search and that kind of stuff. There's levels to it. And until you recognize where you are in that growth towards learning how to really be a strategist, you're stuck in a mindset of thinking you know everything before you do. And I recognize where I am, and I'm not the top marketer in the world either. I do very well for companies, and there's people who I think have great ideas that they're out there to learn from. And I think most marketers don't think that way.
Now, I would absolutely agree with that one. And mate, just lastly, who's someone you look up to in the marketing field? Just as an extension of that question.
Someone I look up to in the business world?
Yeah, in the business world.
Yeah, there's a fellow who I know, his name's Joe Kruger, who has run many companies. He's a business consultant who has all of the skills honed in the financial side and the strategic side of the operations of a business he's just brilliant. And when I have I've never had a meeting with him that didn't make me better. And at the same time, I think he feels that way with meeting with me because I've got sort of that out of the box marketing concept stuff that helps him. So yeah. I really look up to him. He's a great guy.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think that's so important to have professional mentors and yeah. Take someone on. And even, when you're looking at your marketing, I love that idea that, yes, you can become a CMO, right? And if you're looking for strategy in your business, a CMO will give you some out of the box thinking that will bring some value to you. But at the same time, you also need the people who are, savants at Google Ads or whatever it happens to be.
If you want to be whatever title you want, you've got a keyboard, just put it after your name.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't make it legit, but I see that happening all the time. It's the same. I'll get a call on LinkedIn from somebody who wants to meet with me. The next thing you know, they want to be my executive coach and they're 23 years old. And you go, what life experience have you had? Well, I took a course. I know how to. It isn't something that you just proclaim. It's something that you earn. Yeah. My favorite word in the dictionary or whatever you want to call it today is thought leader. If you're the one telling people you're a thought leader, chances are you're probably not. Other people get to decide that.
Yeah. If they start sharing it, then you are. If they don't, then you're not.
Yep.
Awesome, Andrew. I really appreciate your insights and advice today. Guys, you can find Andrew at fangledgroup.com and great podcasts as well. I've listened to a few episodes. Go and jump onto those. And I'm sure there are going to be more coming out again soon. But you can find Andrew also on LinkedIn. Some great articles and advice there. Those details, links, and whatnot will be in the show notes as well. Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much. I had a great time. Always good to see you, Tim.
And guys, really appreciate you joining us on today's episode of More Clients, Less Effort. If you liked today's show or know someone who might find some value from it, please like, share, do all the usual stuff, and we'll catch you on another episode real soon. Take care. Thank you for joining us on today's episode of More Clients, Less Effort. Join us next time for another insightful discussion filled with actionable advice and inspiring stories, all geared towards helping you grow and scale your business simply and easily. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite app so you never miss an episode. See you next time.